I'm in a shade. But every time I do, my family thinks I'm crazy. The hollow earth, UFOs, aliens, and painting. Throw it in the water, they swear the sky's daily. When I talk about these things, they think I'm crazy. There's no escaping anymore, they all that I'm facing. I'm going 90, mind control, they're sacrificing babies. The end of days, but anyways, my family thinks I'm crazy.
As a matter of fact, it looks to me as if, I don't know if you're familiar with, last year there was all sorts of attention paid to an interstellar comet that came through our solar system called 3I Atlas. It looks to me as if the purpose of that interstellar comet was to demonstrate for us the practical applications of all these same energetics I've been talking about. I recognize the use of the same energetics all the way along the track of this comet. Someone paraded what was actually a technological device, but is represented by our misdirecting authorities as a comet. You know, for 4 months, every announcement they made about it was, so guess what? Here's something else that we've never seen in any comet. And then they follow their announcement by saying, oh, and by the way, it's a comet.
You just heard today's guest, author and researcher who joins me, Mystic Mark, here on the My Family Thinks I'm Crazy podcast. Thank you for tuning in and enjoy this conversation with Laird Scranton. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to the My Family Thinks I'm Crazy podcast. I'm your host, Mystic Mark, and joining me today is a guest who's long awaited on this show. He is an independent scholar who's written a series of books on ancient cosmology, language. You may have seen him on Coast to Coast Radio. And I believe I've seen you on several other programs, but your work is really incredible. Tons of books, and you have some new ones on the way as well. Laird Scranton joins us today. Laird, thanks for joining me. How are you today?
I'm great, Mark. Thank you very much for inviting me on. I appreciate it. my family is also crazy, so I can relate. Thinks I'm crazy.
Yeah, well, I'm the crazy one in this family, and I feel like you're right at home then, especially considering all the work you've put out. It's really incredible stuff. So just fill the audience in on what you've been up to lately. You recently put a book out about Chinese cosmology. Is that right?
That's right. I'm about to publish my 15th book. The bulk of those are traditionally published through a subsidiary of Simon & Schuster called Inner Traditions, but it started taking them 18 months to produce a book, and I discovered I could self-publish a book in between. So some years I was publishing two books. Now it's just simpler to self-publish a book. So back in the 1990s, my wife recommended a book to me. It was called Unexplained by Jerome Clark. And every chapter in the book was about some mystery in the world that hadn't been solved. One of the chapters focused on this modern-day primitive African tribe called the Dogon, who live in Mali, which is in the northwest hump of Africa. And the Dogon knew facts, astronomical facts about the star system of Sirius that they really shouldn't know without access to powerful telescopes. And so I realized how interesting that was, and that if I looked into it, it was going to have to lead someplace that was worth exploring. So I began pursuing how could it possibly be that this tribe, which dates back to ancient times, could have known this stuff. So it turns out it was a lucky choice because the Dogon tribe, who are a priestly tribe and whose societal imperative is to preserve original forms of symbols and words and myths and symbolic elements, architecture and things like that. The Dogon culture is a kind of umbrella over a number of classic ancient traditions. They have civic practices like ancient Egypt around 3000 BC, and they have ritual practices like ancient Judaism. They have symbolic elements that tie positively to Hinduism and to Buddhism and to places like that, or groups like that. Their language preserves words from 18 other different languages. Technically, their language is unclassifiable because there are all these other language words, language groupings preserved within it. Turkish words and Tamil words and ancient Egyptian words, Hebrew words, Faroese language words from north of Scotland. Very interesting tribal group. So the Dogon made it their mission to preserve what's called a symbolic cosmology. Basically, if you're familiar with the psychiatrist Carl Jung, who noticed what he called archetypes in ancient societies, that no matter where you went in the world, you would find similar words and similar mythological themes and similar symbols and storylines and similar unusual outlooks. There are cultures who imagine that they insist that there's a wheel or a chariot associated with the stars of Sirius. So the Dogon understood that there are two stars in the Sirius system, a bright sun-like star and then a small dwarf, very heavy, dense dwarf star. Science calls them Sirius A and Sirius B. The Dogon understood that these two stars exist, even though you can't see the small one because it sits in the glare of the big one. But they knew the correct orbital period for the stars. They understood that there's likely a third body in that same system. And they have a lot of the details right about what goes on with binary star systems. It was confusing why all of these ancient cultures emphasize the Sirius stars so much, and everybody has a theory about that. Well, as I began to work with the elements of the Dogon culture and started comparing things to other cultures, I realized that many of the Dogon cosmological words are ancient Egyptian words. And so I could go to an Egyptian hieroglyphic dictionary, and from the form of the ancient Egyptian word, I could clarify what the Dogon were talking about when they used a particular word. As it turns out, the languages of these societies before about 500 BC are all systematized. The Dogon language, every syllable represents a concept, what I call a root concept. And when they want to express a more complicated idea, all they do is they pick and choose the right syllables to combine together to express that more complicated idea. So if I know how a Dogon word was originally pronounced, I can retrieve what the original intended meaning of the word was, even though the language has been around for thousands of years. The same thing's true with ancient Egyptian hieroglyphs, and actually with Chinese hieroglyphs and with other languages. Every glyph represents a concept. And if you treat an Egyptian hieroglyphic word like a rebus puzzle, a child's puzzle, where, you know, you substitute the word I for a picture of an eye and to create a kind of a sentence, that's the way these words work. And I discovered if I had known perfectly, I would have started with a very simple word that means weak. It's pronounced met, and it's only written with two glyphs. The first glyph is a circle with a dot in the middle of it. It's the Egyptian sun glyph. And it can stand for the concept of a day. And the second glyph is an upside-down U shape. And it's the ancient Egyptian number 10. So I looked at that word and I thought, symbolically, the word says 10 days to me. And I did some research and discovered the ancient Egyptians observed a 10-day week. I thought, that's amazing. The simple form of the word just conveyed correct information to me about Egyptian culture that I didn't already know. I wondered if any of the other Egyptian words worked that way. And as it turns out, they all do, every last one. And in fact, there are some ancient Egyptian words where the purpose of the word is to assign a specific meaning to a particular glyph. There's a trailing glyph that is unpronounced at the end of the word. And if you find just those words, you can lay out what the correct symbolism is for each one of their glyphs based on the authority of the ancient Egyptian hieroglyphic language. We don't have to guess at what the scribe meant when he wrote the word. So all of this sort of put me in the position of a fifth grader who suddenly realizes that the reason the teacher's copy of the book is so much thicker than the student's copy is because at the back of the book, they have all of the correct answers to the chapter questions. So the Egyptian hieroglyphic dictionary works this way. If I have a concept I don't understand, the first thing I do is go to the Egyptian hieroglyphic dictionary and I examine the words that pertain to that concept, and the words explain to me what was meant by that when the word was originally used. And then I can confirm that against looking to the Dogon words or to the Buddhist words, Sanskrit words, words of other languages. I can cross-confirm that what the Egyptian hieroglyphs are telling me is really correct.
Mm. Wow. Wow. Yeah, this is very fascinating. The Tower of Babel story comes to mind, although I'm not particularly set in seeing things from that Christian perspective. I find it so fascinating that all these languages have a common connection. And I'm sure you're well aware of the Green Sahara theory, but the Dogon people, for those who aren't geographically acquainted, they're all the way on the western coast of Africa in the sort of western region of the Sahara, whereas classical Egypt is all the way on the eastern side of the northern part of Africa. So given this connection between the Dogon language and the Egyptian language, do you find any, maybe this is verifying the extreme size of the once great Egyptian empire, that maybe the Egyptian empire expanded all the way across the entire northern half of Africa?
Well, that might be true, but what the Dogon are telling us happened is a little bit different than that. You're probably familiar with the Göbekli Tepe site in southeastern Turkey that was about 11,000 years old, where people were raising megalithic pillars and doing interesting carvings of animals in the pillars that represent symbols and so forth. That looks like a very ancient era of instruction, that pretty much every one of those symbols that we see at Göbekli Tepe all represent the same idea. And this is the only real idea that is represented symbolically in any of these ancient cultures. What they're talking about is the dynamics of creational energies. And when I say creational energies, what I mean are magnetism and electricity. And they're given different names in different cultures. In the Samkhya philosophy of India, they're referred to as Purusha and Prakriti. We're talking about how these two energies interact together to create materialized forms like atoms, like spirals of energy, like galaxies and things like that. The same dynamics of energy are said to work on all of the different observational scales. It doesn't matter whether we're paying attention to them on the scale of stars like Sirius or whether we're paying attention to them on the scale of hydrogen atoms. It's all the same dynamics of energy. When the scientists tell us that the quantum world, things suddenly change, that we have no way of observing what the energy is actually doing, the truth is we don't need to observe it directly because according to the ancient traditions, it's all the same dynamics that we see occurring in our own, on our own scale of observation. We don't have to guess what's going on. We know what's going on. We just have to apply it on a different level. So the Dogen outlook is that in ancient times, and they're referring to around 3200 BC, that an instructional effort was mounted by a group of very knowledgeable teachers who thoroughly understood how very deep science works. And the Dogen say that various tribal groups from around the world were taken, they were transported to a remote location where the eight of them at a time were instructed in a civilizing plan for humanity and that was closely tagged to this symbolic cosmology, and then returned back to their homes to pass that instruction along to the other tribes, people that they were connected to. So it looks as if that the location where that happened was on Orkney Island, just north of Scotland. And there's a group of islands up there where the earliest megalithic sites in the United Kingdom appeared. There's a site called the Standing Stones of Stennis, which was a stone circle of 12 stones that was kind of a precursor to structures like Stonehenge later in farther south in the United Kingdom. And it looks as if, based on that first round of instruction that happened at Göbekli Tepe at around 9000 BC, that the group that had done the best job of preserving what they had been taught and able to replicate what the science that was presented in these symbols were the Africans, in particular groups like the Dogon. They're a group, a cluster of North African and West African tribes associated with the Berbers, who are connected to ancient Egypt, who share a lot of the same words in their languages and share a lot of the same symbols. And each one of them sort of preserves a different subset of those to a different extent. And so what I've done is I've conducted a comparative study where I take a symbolic element from any one of these cultures where they give a clear explanation of what they think the symbol represents. And then I test that against all of the other ancient cultures and say, okay, now how did the Hindus understand this symbol, and how did the Buddhists understand it, and how did the Kabbalists understand it? And by doing those cross comparisons, I could kind of triangulate in on what the original meaning of that symbol must have been, and then I could use language to confirm that. I could go to the Egyptian hieroglyphic language and start to familiarize myself with what each of the glyphs represents, because the sentence that defines the concept is going to be a sensible sentence. And the glyphs can only have certain meanings if they're producing a sentence that's going to make sense. And so you can backdoor your way into an idea of what a glyph means, and then later confirm that with other specific Egyptian words. That Egyptian word for week I was talking about was formulated in exactly the same way that the ancient Chinese hieroglyphic word was formulated, for the word for week. And they also observed a 10-day week. So we have eye-to-eye direct comparability between ancient Chinese hieroglyphic words and ancient Egyptian hieroglyphic words in their original forms. So that sort of lends credit to the statements that were made on the part of those cultures that their languages were gifted to them by somebody. It looks as if they were part of this instructed tradition, and various groups came away with different forms of this symbolic language.
Yeah. Now, can we get into some of the other similarities? I know from your work, you talk about a serpent religion. I've seen this in other places as well. Many people have found this pattern that at this same nexus point in human culture, there's also a prevalence of serpent symbolism.
Right. Now, the reason for that is, I was saying there's only one subject that the symbolic tradition focuses on. It's the interaction of these two creational energies. And literally everything comes down to some aspect of that. When they say creation, they're really talking about four things. They're talking about how the universe was created, how matter was created, how biological life comes about, and how consciousness comes about. And according to the Dogen, a single cluster of dynamics of energy are responsible for all four of those things. And so, as a way to emphasize the parallelism of those four themes, groups like the ancient Egyptians developed systems of symbols, a progression of symbols that simultaneously represented all four of those themes. So this means that every symbol that we look at actually carries a cluster of meanings. So for example, the hemisphere glyph, the shape of a hemisphere, if we're talking about biological reproduction, represents the shape of a woman's expanded womb. If we're talking about how matter forms, that same shape represents the expansion of mass that produces material forms. So these are related meanings, but technically different. The symbolism starts to get very complicated because you can't ask the question, can't properly ask, what does this symbol represent? You have to ask, what does it represent if we're talking about consciousness, or what does it represent if we're talking about the formation of the universe? And so when you go to the Egyptian hieroglyphic dictionary, you'll have, half a dozen different words that I consider to be defining words for a symbol. Each one of them is assigning a meaning to the symbol. And they're all correct. And so you end up with researchers who can't agree on what the symbol meant because careful researchers have sorted out actual meanings of the symbol, but they aren't the same meanings as another researcher has sorted out, and they don't realize there's an umbrella perspective over the whole thing, that both researchers are right. I've come around to the point of view that when a very careful researcher, like my friend John Anthony West, who died a few years ago, would be dead set on the idea that a symbol represented something very different than what I thought it represented, that was an indication that this was one of those clustered meanings situations, and that there was an umbrella perspective that I didn't understand yet that I needed to look for that would cover both of those meanings. And so that's the way I tend to treat when someone comes up with proposes, an explanation for things that is not 100% in alignment with how I understand things. The thing I immediately do is I start looking for how does what they think is true connect to what I think is true. Now, there are some researchers who are just making stuff up, but anytime I'm dealing with what I consider to be a careful researcher, I try to take seriously what they're telling me about one of these symbolic elements.
Right. Now, on that note, there is some evidence in the form of a Buddhist stupa that helps legitimize the global tradition. Can you help us understand what is going on there? They're involving an anthropologist named Peter Van Beek.
Yeah, the Dogen system is parallel to the Buddhist system, that their symbolic cosmology has a grand symbol, and that grand symbol is an aligned shrine that looks to me like an archaic form of a Buddhist stupa. A stupa is a shrine that was carefully designed to align with the four cardinal points of the compass, north, south, east, and west. And there's geometry they use to make that happen. People have debated, how did they get the alignment so perfectly? And they imagine they were sighting to the North Star, or they were doing other exotic things to try to get this thing aligned. But actually, it's much simpler than that. What they were doing, what they did was they stuck a stick vertically in a field, an empty field, and then drew a circle around it at a distance of a radius of 10 cubits. A cubit represents either the distance from a person's elbow to the tip of their finger, or it can also represent the average pace or step of a person. So they would mark out with paces 10 cubits, then draw a circle around that stick. In the morning when the sun rose up, it would cast a shadow. The stick would cast a shadow that would intersect that circle. And they would mark the point where the point of intersection. And then they'd do the same thing with the late at night with the last shadow of the day that intersected the circle. They would mark where it intersected the circle. Now, because the sun rises in the east and sets in the west, that line is automatically east-west aligned. Nothing special has to be done except mark the points. And then from there, there's some fairly simple geometry that you probably learned in math geometry class when you were in high school, that they can derive north and south points that are similarly aligned perfectly, all because of what the sun does. The sum of that geometry, the Buddhists tell us, replicates how space actually emerges, and I'm at a point where I understand scientifically that that's correct, that as we understand that space progressively expands, and as it expands in the same form that this geometry that's used to align the Buddhist stupa. It's also used to align shrines in Islam. It was used to align important civic centers in ancient China. It was used to theoretically to align the pyramids in Egypt.
Right.
So the stupa is an important symbol, and it represents a very important concept in the materialization of energy.
I think it also an advanced knowledge that is counter to maybe our traditional anthropological understanding of human development, right? I mean, we're kind of given this in school, this idea, you know, this notion that man evolved over this period of time. You feel like finding information like this that conveys the advanced nature of ancient humans maybe runs counter to that? I mean,
yes, my friend John Anthony West used to loudly rail against what he called the school of progress, which is we're taught in our schools to imagine that the history of humanity is one long progression in which we just get smarter and smarter and smarter and smarter and smarter and smarter. And now humanity in the present day is theoretically the pinnacle of human intelligence of all time. But the symbolic system absolutely contradicts that. I'm at a point in my studies where when I come turn up a new ancient symbolic concept, the only way I have of confirming the scientific reasonableness of the concept is by reference to the top physicists of the 1920s and 1930s, people like Albert Einstein, but more often people like a French physicist named Louis de Broglie, or Schrödinger, Sir Arthur Eddington, George Gamow from Paul Dirac. These are all top physicists of the 1920s and 30s, many of whom took the time to write books aimed at a layperson like myself, you know, that were not all filled with scientific formulas, but rather would express in plain English what the history of the development of our knowledge of physics has been, and why, you know, this person's research contradicted and supplanted that person's research, you know, what the issue was and how it got decided. And so just to put in plain English terms for us, basically reducing fractions for us, which is what the ancient tradition is superb at, that it understands that a very complicated fraction in mathematics might reduce down to a very simple fraction, like a third or a half. It's much easier for us to understand the value of a fraction like a half than it is something that's expressed in much larger numbers. So the main thrust of the symbolic tradition was to reduce everything down to the simplest form. And so when they talk about what happens with atoms, they're discussing hydrogen atoms, which are the simplest hydrogen atoms, because what happens with a hydrogen atom is true for every other atom. And things are less complicated if you can reduce things down to their simplest form. So what I've done is, besides trying to verify that all of these ancient societies understood the symbolic elements in the same way as each other, I've also tried to positively demonstrate how those symbols connect to actual science. The Dogon flatly say that their system is science. The first written statement of the Samkhya philosophy in India insisted that it was objective science. This is not, we're not talking about religion. We're not talking just about spirituality. We're talking about objective science.
Yeah, and that is what is over and over so fascinating about this material, and specifically your approach to this material. For those who aren't familiar with your background, you have a background in independent software design. And I imagine, you know, this sort of systematic or technical mindset has helped you not only, let's say, decrypt the hieroglyphic symbol sets, but also be able to interpret these more complex ideas hidden within them. And again, you know, going back to your friend John Anthony West's passion, and I think we're passionate about that on this show too, this progress idea. Can you help us maybe understand some of these examples? I have here in my notes the weaver of matter, the goddess Neith. These glyphs used to write her name have similarities to certain things, scientific diagrams, and things that we use today in modern physics.
Well, Einstein said that if energy naturally materialized into materialized forms and naturally evolved into biological forms and things like that, that the processes that make that happen necessarily had to be very simple ones. And so he was working to try to understand what they were. The Dogon and the Egyptian cosmologies get us down to what those are. That basically every materialized form you can think of, atoms and particles of energy, things like electrons, they all arise from a single dynamic of the creational energies. What happens is these energies, natural tendency is to form two types of waves. One wave is called a standing wave. It's basically a wave, if you imagine a wave in a swimming pool that bounces back and forth from between the walls of the swimming pool, and if it had enough energy, it would keep going on and on and on. That's a standing wave. The other kind of wave is called a traveling wave. And the way those two waves interact with each other tend to naturally produce certain geometric forms. One of the forms is the geometry of a hydrogen atom, a circle with a dot in the middle, basically an electron orbiting a proton. Another form they produce, if the energy, it produces that first form if the energies are basically still through a process called acoustic radiation, even though it's named as being acoustic, which relates to sound, but it really applies to energy all across the spectrum of energy, not just to sound. Now, if the energy happens to be moving, it tends to produce a shape called a beat frequency, which is the Vesica Pisces shape. It's almond shape, and it's one of the key interfaces between energy and materialized forms. If the energy happens to be rotating in an expanding space, it produces what's called a spiral. This, the definition of a spiral is energy rotating in an expanding space. So that by the time it gets back around to where it came from, the space around it has expanded. So now it misses the end point of where it started from, and it spirals around the outside of itself. Now, the reason that energy is both wave-like and particle-like, which is one of the fundamentals of quantum physics, is because waves of energy have a tendency to self-differentiate themselves into these little beat frequencies. You'll be familiar with what a beat frequency is. If you've ever driven your car on the highway and rolled down just one window, you probably heard a whacka, 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 whacka sound. That's a beat frequency. And the reason it happens is because the two waves of energy that are involved, at one point in their cycle of energy, the waves align with each other. The troughs and the peaks of the waves are in alignment with each other, and so they reinforce each other, and the sound gets louder. At other points in the cycle, they misalign with each other. They cancel each other, and so the sound goes to zero, and so the sound moves from nothing to loud. Repeatedly. It's a beat frequency. So de Broglie was the one who understood that the energy levels of a hydrogen atom they correspond to points of resonance for those energies. And the energies that are involved, he graphed. He produced two graphs. One takes the almond shape I was just talking about, and the other one looks like a zigzag line. Those two shapes I recognized as being ancient Egyptian glyphs, and I started scoping out what Egyptian words are written with just those two shapes. One of them is what Sir Wallace Budge, who created the Egyptian Hieroglyphic Dictionary, interprets to be the divine name, even though these ancient traditions don't actually deify anything. They understand all this as science, and you can tell that because of what they name things. The names reveal what the scientific meaning of the element is. And so even when you get down to the Dogon supposedly creator god Amma, you can tell from the form of Amma's name that Amma represents scientific concepts. Am is the concept of knowledge, and Amma is the concept of perception. So Amma is defined in terms of energetics that produce consciousness. But it's all science. And the further down you go, the more you can demonstrate that it's science.
Yeah.
And it's all correct science. So far, I have not come across anything that the Dogon or Egyptians, or for that matter, the Buddhists or the Hindus, represent in their cosmologies that isn't ultimately correct science and very deep science, deeper than any of the popularizers of science like Stephen Hawking or Brian Greene or Michio Kaku talk about.
Stop right there, folks. Thank you for tuning into this episode of the My Family Thinks I'm Crazy podcast with today's guest, Laird Scranton. If you want every episode, including this one, ad-free and interruption-free, sign up on the Patreon or the Substack. That's patreon.com/mftic or myfamilythinksimcrazy.substack.com. If you do so, you support the show, you help me continue to put great episodes like this one out each week. So, with that in mind, let's go over to our new sponsor. They've sponsored us in the past, and they're back with an incredible deal, okay? It's very simple. You're going to use this promo code CRAZY50 at Gold Main Street, okay? What's Gold Main Street? Gold Main Street is your number one supplier of real THC, live rosins, solventless hashes, and so much more. I love Gold Main Street. I'm telling you, buying hemp online isn't a gamble anymore with goldmainstreet.com. It's curated craft hemp brands that meet rigorous standards, lab-tested, farm bill compliant, and sourced with care, okay? It's not available in every state, so go to the website and find out if you apply, if you're able to buy. But when you are on the website, you can add $50 or more of products to the cart and use code CRAZY50 at checkout. And the code takes $50 off. All you have to do is pay shipping. I mean, that's virtually free weed. I don't know about you, but I'm going to do it right now. It works one time, and there's one use per customer. You can't combine it with other discounts, and only 300 total buyers are available to access this amazing deal. So remember, CRAZY50 at checkout for the first 200 customers. Use CRAZY50 and get what feels like a first free order. Just load up $50 or more in your cart and pay just shipping. So check that out right now. Remember, CRAZY50 at goldmainstreet.com. That's CRAZY50 at goldmainstreet.com. Now, let's get back to this episode with Laird Scranton after this quick break to our dynamic ads. Listeners of the My Family Thinks I'm Crazy podcast, I've got big news, okay? I have gone with Mars Men. Not to Mars, not to the moon. No, right here on Earth, I've achieved higher levels of manliness and greatness, of intellectual capacities, of accomplishing confidence and my goals to the utmost. Like, for example, today I took Mars Men for the first time, which has Tonga Ali, She Legit, which we all know and love She Legit, K1 and K2, vitamin D, zinc, taurine, fenugreek, and boron. Okay, this is a stack. This is clinically dosed and effective to do what? Well, it increases free testosterone in some cases with boron. Shilajit boosts testosterone. Tonga Ali boosts testosterone. Okay, we're stacking the effects here. It's made in a cGMP facility. It's hormone-free, obviously non-GMO, vegan, third-party tested, and made in the USA, not on Mars. It's made in the USA. For the listeners of this podcast, you're going to get an incredible discount. You get 50% off for life, free shipping, and three gifts at Mars Men. Go to mengotomars.com. You got to use the hyperlink in the episode description. That's mengotomars.com. But use the URL because that's going to take you straight to the promotion. And I love it. I took it today for the first time, and I'm telling you, it was like a new man awoke within me. And I'm sorry to all the people who are going to have to hear this ad multiple times, but it is what it is. I jumped in the water, and I was renewed, okay? And I think the Mars Men had something to do with it, all right? So with that, check it out today. Boost your testosterone naturally with Mars Men. Go to marsmen.com. You've got weight loss goals, but hitting them is another story. Enter Weight Loss by Hims. It's designed to support you in losing the weight and keeping it off. And Hims now offers access to an affordable range of FDA-approved GLP-1 medications, including Wegovy and the Wegovy pen. You don't want to just lose weight. You want to look better and feel better. And with Wegovy at Hims, you can lose up to 20% or more of your body weight when combined with diet and exercise. And Mystic Mark really emphasizes the diet and exercise. Maybe skip the Wegovy altogether and just do the diet and exercise. Oh, wait, hold on. They told me not to say that. It helps you regulate your appetite and eat less, so success is within reach. And sometimes we need a little extra help, and there's no shame in that. So with Hims, everything happens online. You'll connect with a licensed provider who will determine if treatment is right for you. If prescribed, your medication is delivered right to your door, no insurance necessary, and it doesn't stop there. Hims makes hitting your goals seamless by offering access to 24/7 messaging with your care team, an in-app lifestyle nutrition support like recipes, meal plans, fitness videos, sleep content, and more. Even better, with a range of affordable GLP-1 options, Hims makes it simple to find a weight loss approach that fits your world and your wallet. If eligible, you'll get a treatment plan personalized to you and unlimited dosage changes as needed. Ready to reach your goals? Visit hims.com/crazy to get a personalized, affordable plan that gets you. That's hims.com/crazy, hims.com/crazy. Weight loss by Hims is not available in all 50 states. Wegovy is the registered trademark of Novo Nordisk AS. To get started and learn more, included important safety information, Wegovy clinical study information and restrictions, visit hims.com for all that. Yeah, it definitely feels like there's a larger body of universal truth that, you know, blame academia, blame society and governments. I mean, there's all sorts of sociological explanations, but it just feels like we get a watered down, non-holistic version of that universal truth. Whereas when we look into the past and we see these sophisticated, complex, rich, symbolic languages, it feels like people living in that time would have had a more complex understanding of the world around them. Do you feel like that's true?
Right, because these symbolic concepts, these scientific concepts, were integrated with the structures of society in a mnemonic way. For example, the way that the Dogon lay out their agricultural plots replicates a scientific concept of energy called a percolation cluster. The Dogon, their typical unit of agriculture is 8 plots of land by 8 plots of land in a square with a well, a commonly shared well at the center. And that is the most efficient way to distribute water to the plots of land and the most efficient way to distribute energy in the universe. Everything the Dogon do, the way they plant their seeds, okay, the understanding is that a particle, a quantum particle that's in motion, is traveling inside of a little conceptual energetic tube. The Dogon represent that with the furrow that they create with their hoe that they plant their seeds in as they go along. And that all comes about because of this, the interaction of this standing wave and the traveling wave. When the Dogon plant their seed, they walk forward along that, creating this furrow. But every time they plant a seed, they move their hoe to the other hand and step on the other foot. So what they're integrating in their physical motions are the actions of that oscillating wave back and forth, left and right, and the traveling wave moving forward. Everything that we consider to be real comes down to the interaction of those two types of waves. Everything. Adrian Snodgrass, who wrote a book called The Symbolism of the Stupa, said, you know, in a stupa shrine, the only architectural element, that symbolic architectural element that is really essential, is the axis. The axis at the center. And the reason it's essential is because the two waves I've been talking about come about through the interaction of something called Alfven waves, A-L-F-V-E-N. Alfven waves are a kind of primordial form of magnetism, and they express themselves as tiny threads that are locked into plasma energy out in space and in contact with the sun and with the Earth and other astronomical bodies. Those Alfven waves tend to move with the plasma. They can't move by themselves. They're locked in. So the normal form of an alpha wave is linear. And if you end up combining a linear alpha wave moving in one direction with the linear alpha wave moving in the other direction, which happens a lot, you create a standing wave. But if that standing wave happens to hit an obstacle, then a transformation happens, and suddenly now it becomes what's called a transverse wave, which it runs perpendicularly to the traveling wave. I mean, the standing wave. I'm sorry, I said that backwards. The linear wave is the traveling wave, and the transverse wave is the standing wave. But those two types of threads, which are compared to threads of flax, intersect each other the same way that the axis in a Buddhist stupa does. That axis is very important because, okay, let's go back to de Broglie graphing a hydrogen atom. He graphed two oscillations of energy that govern a hydrogen atom. He did this in 1924, and he published a very important paper on it that was highly praised by Einstein and Schrodinger and people like that. In fact, Schrodinger even used de Broglie's paper as the foundation for his quantum theory. However, that 1924 paper got disappeared. It was never translated into another language. I don't see any references to it in the later works of people like Einstein or de Broglie or Schrodinger. No mention of the key concept, which is resonance. It was not until 2018 that a Quebecan physicist by the name of André Michaud, who I have had contacts with, published a paper where he brought this 1924 paper to the public attention and said, look, because of this paper of de Broglie's, we understand that resonance is one of the key principles at play with these energies. Resonance is the point at which the wavelength of one of the energies becomes an even factor of the other energy. So if the larger energy has a wavelength of 9 units, it's really the other way around. One of them has a wavelength of 9 units, the other one has a wavelength of 3 units, the 3 units fit evenly into the 9. And so you now have a point of resonance. If we were talking about music, those points of resonance are the notes on a musical scale, 7 notes in a scale. The Dogen say that there are 7 resonance points in a half cycle of this oscillating energy. But the half cycle actually has 2 modes. In the first mode, it's creating materialized forms. And in the other mode, it's deconstructing those materialized forms. So all in total, you have 14 equivalents, 14 resonance points that one of those beat frequencies of energy self-divides itself into. You can think of those in the same way that we think of, you know, in deep seawater. Deep seawater self-differentiates itself into biological zones where the type of life that lives very near the surface is very different than the type of life that crawls along the floor of the ocean. And certain forms of life can exist in more than one of those biological domains. Other forms can't. Certain forms can cross them like a whale, but we can't. We can in a submarine, but a lot of life forms can't. A fish at the surface can't go to the floor of the ocean. So those biological zones or those energetic zones that naturally differentiate in energy, Hinduism refers to as levels of consciousness, because the same energetics that produce material forms also have the potential to produce consciousness. And so every one of those 14 zones represents its own life forms and its own forms of consciousness. Every one of those zones has a proper name anciently, and the names are formulated according to a system, so it's possible to recognize what they are. I was saying that when I I realized that de Broglie's graphs were Egyptian glyphs, the almond shape and the zigzag line, and that they produced, they're used to spell a word that Budge considered to be the divine name. With Egyptian hieroglyphs, they didn't include the vowel sounds. Just like ancient Hebrew, they don't write the vowel sounds, because anybody who's familiar with the words in the language doesn't need the vowel sounds. You can probably read an English sentence without the vowels. It's a security measure, so that someone who doesn't understand this stuff will have a hard time figuring it out. So Budge didn't have the correct vowel sounds to use with his word, so he knew the consonants, and he decided that the divine name was pronounced Ren, R-E-N, or R-E-N-N. That word is written with just those two glyphs. I realized, because there's a kind of consensus viewpoint on what the ancient phonetics of this tradition were, that emerge as the more you study the different languages and the different systems, you come to realize what the proper phonetic is, and most of those are preserved in the Dogon language. Some of them are preserved in the Egyptian hieroglyphic language, or some are both. The proper pronunciation of the word should be re-na. Re is a syllable that refers to energy, and na is a syllable that refers to the non-material feminine. So these two energies that define a hydrogen atom are defined anciently as the energy of the non-material feminine. This is the resonant aspect of a hydrogen atom, and that's an aspect of hydrogen atom. Of energy itself that I had no idea existed until I tumbled to what Rene Guénon was saying. Actually, what tipped me off to it was a very intuitive friend of mine sent me a picture of a crop circle in the United Kingdom a couple of years ago. I had just finished writing a chapter in a book about hydrogen atoms, and I thought I had said everything that was significant symbolically about a hydrogen atom, and then she sends me this crop circle, and it's the configuration of a water molecule, but at the center of it are almond-shaped forms that I didn't recognize what they were. And so I did more research, and I discovered they represented what was called the resonant form of the water molecule. And so now I understood that there was a whole other aspect of the hydrogen atom that I hadn't touched, the resonant aspect of the hydrogen atom, that was actually where everything was happening. It's basically a hidden aspect. Anciently, it's referred to as hidden energy because it's not obvious. It's even.
Well, you mentioned crop circles, and I was curious. We've seen advanced information conveyed in crop circles. What do you make of that?
Well, I have a very well informed friend who just today messaged me and said, with a link from a guy who's ostensibly created hundreds of crop circles as what she calls artwork, not as a hoax. My problem is that you could distinguish a genuine crop circle from a hoaxed one because of what happens to the plants in the circle. That in a genuine crop circle, every plant is bent over because it has been heated at the knuckle of the plant, which then causes the plant to bend over. But it doesn't damage the plant. The plant would continue to grow if you left it that way. But every plant that creates the crop circle image has been modified that way. I don't know of any artist or any hoaxer who can demonstrate for us how they do that. I know how it comes about because back in the 90s, I happened across a couple of articles that just coincidentally explained it to me. Back then, a group of botanists were trying to find a way to get plants growing in a field to shake off harmful insects. And so they were using lasers to create what are called flectural waves. And flectural waves cause these plants to shake. And so had conducted all of these experiments to try to make that happen. And they discovered that when the flectural wave hit 15 kilohertz, suddenly the plant was heated at the knuckle and bent over just like in a crop circle. They didn't connect it to crop circles. They just noted the effect. So I now understand that whoever is producing these crop circles, it's basically a parlor trick, but a very sophisticated one. You can imagine that if someone had the equivalent of a PC printer on a satellite, only it was hooked up to a bank of lasers instead of to inkjets, that they could pick any image they wanted to off the internet and press click and print a crop circle in a field. I'm not saying that's how they come about. It looks to me like they come about through the efforts of plasma orbs, which have their own level of intelligence. But I do think that a percentage of the crop circles are absolutely genuine. And we can affirm that by the fact that oftentimes a series of crop circles in the same region or in the same field carry a creational theme, that they reflect different progressive stages of the energies I'm talking about, which is knowledge that your average person doesn't have. Your average artist or your average hoaxer would not know that this shape should follow that shape, and that this third shape should follow the second shape. And so the crop circles themselves reflect insider knowledge of the system that I've been researching. And there aren't very many people who have that.
Yeah.
So I don't believe that every crop circle is hoaxed. I believe that some of them are genuine. There are also other energetic effects and radiation effects and things like that that have been documented that no hoaxer could have produced.
Well, and on that note, you know, let's rule out the percentage of hoaxer, the human, you know, side, because there's a percentage of human created crop circles. Do you believe that there is an origin to these that we can discern? And I know oftentimes people, when they think of this stuff, they think of UFOs and aliens. Obviously, your work is not rooted in that. It's rooted in this ancient history, but, you know, there's many people who believe that maybe there's an alternative reality or a way that things can be, information can be conveyed through time. I mean, aside from this.
Yes, well, I had talked about the domains, the Hindu domains of consciousness, which are energetic domains. Each with its own life form and its ability to think and take action and do things like that. The Dogen perspective is that towards the middle of the energetic cycle, okay, let me explain how this works. If we go down into deep seawater in a submarine where the pressure is very great outside, it's not safe for us to try to leave the submarine, unless we first step into an airlock and equalize the pressure inside the airlock to what it is outside. Once we've equalized that pressure, now it's perfectly safe for us to move across from the submarine into the water, or same thing in space. If we can equalize the pressure in an airlock, now it's safe for us to step out of the spacecraft into outer space. Otherwise, it wouldn't be. So the way the energetics work over a long time scale, I was talking about the beat frequency having two modes. Well, these energetics repeat on all scales. And so at the scale of universes, there's a cycle that we call the Yuga cycle. That's all the same energetics. It's a 12,000 year half cycle. And the idea is that energy and mass is shifting in the same way that sand shifts in an hourglass. All the sand starts in the top globe, and it slowly drifts down into the bottom globe. If we, what that sand represents energetically is energy and mass, which Einstein says corresponds to the pace of time. The perspective is that originally the pace of time ran very quickly, and now it runs more slowly. Well, halfway through that half cycle, there's the same amount of sand in the bottom globe as there is in the top globe, and so the time frames have equalized. Now, theoretically, it's possible for a consciousness that's energetic to move to the material domain, and that's what the Dogen say happened. The middle of that last half cycle was around 3600 BC. It's about the time of the start of the Hebrew calendar. And during that era is when instruction begins on Orkney Island, and The Dogons say that one of these classes of energetic consciousness was able to take material form and interact with us in sort of restricted ways. You probably are familiar with the story of Moses on the mountain talking with the burning bush. That burning bush takes a form similar to the orbs we've seen pictures of in the skies over New Jersey and Scandinavia. The Israelites who were down around the base of the mountain were cautioned not to approach too close to the mountain because of the bad effects that could happen to them. The Dogons say that their energetic teachers were very concerned about the bad effects that might accrue to us if we spent too much time with them. And so their solution to that was they enlisted a group of student or assistant teachers, and the group they enlisted were the Dogon, because the Dogon had done the best job of preserving the first round of instruction. They were already familiar with all the concepts, and they could act as student teachers for the different groups that they were instructing. When those groups were returned home, it looks as if a handful of those student teachers went with them and helped them set up the structures of government and of the priesthood, which at that time was the same thing as science. So despite that, okay, so from that perspective, the system I'm talking about is the product of non-human consciousness that is takes an energetic form. It takes a plasma form. But that does not mean that traditional sci-fi aliens don't also exist. It looks to me as if throughout the history of mankind, we've had interactions with both kinds of non-human entities. As a matter of fact, it looks to me as if, I don't know if you're familiar with, last year there was all sorts of attention paid to an interstellar comet that came through our solar system called 3I Atlas.
Yeah.
It looks to me as if the purpose of that interstellar comet was to demonstrate for us the practical applications of all these same energetics I've been talking about. I recognize the use of the same energetics all the way along the track of this comet. Someone paraded what was actually a technological device, but is represented by our misdirecting authorities as a comet. You know, for 4 months, every announcement they made about it was, oh, guess what? Here's something else that we've never seen in any comet. And then they follow their announcement by saying, oh, and by the way, it's a comet. So I was taught when you have more than one solution to a scientific question, the job of the researcher is to sincerely explore all the possibilities. And so every time they would announce an attribute that didn't apply to any comet, I asked myself, could that apply to any given technology? And it turns out there is a specific technology that all of those anomalous attributes apply to. And it's capable of producing what are called Wakefield bubbles, which are warp bubbles similar to what a Star Trek ship uses in fiction. It's a scientifically tested way. It's been tested on quantum scales, and it can accelerate a quantum particle to speeds at least close to the speed of light, if not exceeding the speed of light from our perspective. Let me try to explain that. The speed of light is a fundamental limit. But these domains of energy I was talking about are differentiated by different speeds of light. Different speeds of time. Different time runs more quickly as you move back into these domains. So if something were moving at the speed of light in the domain that just precedes ours, the difference is a factor of 10. The time frame varies by factors of 10. So if we're moving at the speed of light in the domain just precedes ours, we would perceive it as moving 10 times the speed of light, even though it had not exceeded the speed of light. Light was still a limit, but our perspective of it was that it would be moving more quickly than the speed of light. And that's the way these warp bubbles work. Is what they do is they create an environment where the object that's inside the bubble doesn't change speed from what it was at when the bubble formed. The bubble itself is energetic, so it's not restricted by relativistic effects. it can move as fast as we can accelerate it.
Yeah.
And so they have ways with lasers to accelerate these bubbles to speeds that are either, as said, at least close to the speed of light, if not faster than the speed of light. My sources indicate that, multiple sources indicate that 3I Atlas, as it moved away from the Earth, first of all, it approached the Earth at the speed of light, because then the nearest star in the direction it came from was 9 light years away from us, which would have taken it thousands of years at the speed it was moving. It was first recorded at moving at 152,000 miles per hour, which is pretty fast, but it's not a fraction of warp speed. But it is a significant number. It's not just an incidental number. 152,000 miles per hour is the speed that an object is typically accelerated to when it uses the sun for a gravitational assist. So the speed that the scientists recorded this object at when it arrived, presumably when it arrived, it collapsed its warp bubble and dropped back to speeds that are meaningful in the context of our solar system. The speed they tracked it at, 152,000 miles, implies that the warp bubble formed when it was moving 152,000 miles, which meant that it was in very close proximity to a sun-like star. Guess what? Now we know how to form a warp bubble. You got to be close to a star.
Yeah.
The way that comes about is those alpha waves that I talked about, which are little threads, prevail. They're prevalent at the distance from the sun that 3I Atlas approached. And as it approached that sphere of the sun, its speed suddenly reaccelerated from 130,000 miles an hour to 152,000 miles an hour. In other words, it reinvigorated its warp bubble. And then as it moved away from the Earth, or farther and farther away from the sun, my sources, multiple credible sources, like the ESA's scientific search engine, were citing credible sources that placed it near Saturn after 11 days after it left the sun, which meant it was moving millions of miles an hour. It placed it near Neptune shortly after that, Uranus shortly after that, and then near Neptune by the 21 days after it left the sun, which meant it had been moving tens of millions of miles per hour. It's simple math. You take the distance it's moved by the number of hours it's been traveling, and you get the speed. When it moved beyond Neptune, suddenly my sources were saying its speed had dropped to 152,000 miles per hour. I know that's the speed that the object inside the bubble is moving at, and I verified that scientists would detect that. So I had the sense to ask the various AI search engines that I was working with, what would the apparent speed have been of that object to an observer who was watching it? And it came back and it said 1.4 times the speed of light. Then I did some research. That seemed like an odd number to me. I did some research. Could 1.4 times the speed of light be kind of a magic value for faster than light speed? And it turns out it is. It has natural harmonics with the structure of space and the structure of energy in the universe. And so it's sort of an idealized number that if someone were going to travel faster than the speed of light, they'd probably pick that as the speed they wanted to go. Those alpha waves are the source of the energetics that made this object do what it does. And that was my first exposure to even the concept of alpha waves. And now suddenly I realize all of those structures of matter that I have been writing about arise because of the interactions of the alpha waves, even down to the energetics at the scale of a hydrogen atom. Even before that, when you talk, there are structures that make up the foundation of an electron that it's scientifically credible that those are the product of these same alpha waves, because they come about due to the two kinds of waves I was talking about, the standing wave and the traveling wave. Anytime you see one of these shapes, or anytime you realize that those two waves are involved, it's alpha waves that are making it happen. But what was even more astounding to me was the energetics that the 3i Atlas went through as it approached the sun to try to reinvigorate its warp bubble were the same energetics that a proton-electron pair goes through when it forms a hydrogen atom, which suggested to me that a hydrogen atom might actually be a Wakefield bubble, one of these warp bubbles. And it turns out that perspective tests out that all of the signature aspects of a hydrogen atom are the same as the signature aspects of a Wakefield bubble, and the formation of it comes about through those same dynamics of energy that made the 3i Atlas reinvigorate its, or allowed it to reinvigorate its bubble. So in effect, if one of these energetic consciousnesses, I have to back up some more. Rene Guénon, who is the go-to metaphysician who talks about Hindu energetics, he said that the only way a person learns about these esoteric concepts is through an initiate process. It's basically an apprenticeship process. One student pairs with one informant, and the student learns that by the side of the informant all of these essential skills and concepts. He says, occasionally there's somebody like me who doesn't have an informant, and it looks like they've self-initiated, which is what it looks like to me. He says, that's not what the case of what's happening. What happens, in truth, is that they get paired with one of these non-material consciousnesses, and that non-material consciousness acts as their informant. So it looks to me as if with 3i Atlas, if one of those non-material consciousnesses had been intending to present me with a final exam on how well do I understand these energetics, they couldn't have done better than to have paraded that 3i Atlas object across our planetary system.
Mm.
They showed us, as I said, stage by stage, what you should and should not do with a warp bubble, which is the piece of technology that we as humanity are missing in order to join them, to interact with these non-material consciousnesses and universes, solar systems, actually galaxies that are different from ours.
Yeah. Wow. That's fascinating explanation. I really appreciate you taking us through that. The sort of ideas of planet Nibiru come to mind when you talk about this object. Obviously, this is much smaller than what a planet would be, but using these sorts of Alphen waves, could something like what we're told in this Nibiru mythology, could this be possible, a planet-sized object able to move outside of solar systems and into other solar systems, or be in a solar system in such a way that it's sort of outside of perception for the other planets within that solar system?
That's a complicated question. Yes, it's possible. The Alphen waves are at work on all scales of interaction, of observation, even all the way down to a level that precedes the formation of protons. It's a level where energy naturally creates knots called instanton knots. There's every indication that the structures inside those instanton knots were formed by Alphen waves. So this is the pervasive bottom line unit of materializing energy are the Alphen waves. Now, what's really interesting is over the course of my studies, I've had numbers of times where I suspected that whoever developed the particular metaphor that was used anciently to represent this thing had positive knowledge of how we were going to look at it, because our scientists expressed an idea. They might have a dozen different options for how to represent it intuitively to us, but the example they pick, when I go to these dictionaries, I discover that same concept is always represented in those dictionaries. So I was suspecting that I now have to back up again. Those two oscillations of time that govern the hydrogen atom, the Standing Wave and the Traveling Wave have different speed potentials. De Broglie says that the Standing Wave occurs at 99.9% of the speed of light, which is ultra so quick we can't measure it. We have to treat it as if it's theoretical because if we can't measure it, we can't consider it real. The Traveling Wave is much slower. It occurs. It's the speed that the electron orbits at. It's 2% of the speed of light. And so for us, that has reality to it, but this is all a function of how fast the time frame is. So those changes in the pace of time are also reflected in these Southern waves, that the Standing Wave variety moves has a potential to move much more quickly than the Traveling Wave. And so they seem to be the conduits of two modes of time to us. I was confused when I started learning about Egyptian hieroglyphs because they have two Egyptian glyphs that represent the concept of time. Why do they need that? They need it because there are two modes of time. We experience one of them. The one mode, the slower mode, is linear and sequential. But the quicker mode is ultra quick, to the point that from our perspective, it makes it look as if all events happen at once. And the Alphan waves, when they intersect, are the conduits, apparently the conduits, of the interface of those two modes of time. Every event that happens affects both of them. So if you've ever had a sense that somebody legitimately has insight into an event that hasn't happened yet, it's theoretically possible that they are able to connect with that ultra-quick oscillation of time and see a little bit further ahead than the rest of us can and actually have a clairvoyant view of what is likely to happen. The thing is that it's not absolutely guaranteed to happen, that as with the I Ching, it really only represents a set of possibilities that aren't actually pinned down until the thing occurs.
Yeah, this sort of...
That produces a reality for us that is called quantum coherent. The way to understand that is to think of a jazz combo where every player in the combo has ultimate latitude to play whatever they want as long as it's in keeping with the overall piece that the group is playing. That's the way these two modes of time work, that any event is possible, but it ends up having to be in harmony with the overall picture of what's going on.
Wow. It's a beautiful way to put it when we consider the collective consciousness and our effect as human beings, albeit at this point in our contemporary history, maybe not a very harmonious note in Earth's history, but still nonetheless, I think something like that gives me hope as an optimist that we can together as humanity evolve to a place where, our consciousness is at a certain collective vibration that certain negative, what we perceive now as negative things aren't even possible because of the ultimate harmony of everyone else. But anyways.
Right. Now, another thing related to what I'm talking about that should give you hope is that the non-material consciousness that was able to take form as the mythical Dogon teachers, who they're called the Pneumo. The Egyptian word is Pneuma, which literally means waves perceived. They were one of three classes of energetic orbs that are defined in the Dogon system called, the Egyptians called them Aku orbs. The Dogon called them Ogo. The Dogon say that there are three classes of them. And collectively, one of their primary purposes is to act as messengers between those domains of Hindu-like domains of consciousness I was talking about. They communicate between a primordial level of consciousness that's not deified, it's the feminine consciousness, and the other levels of consciousness. Um, we only get a few glimpses into the character of that primordial consciousness, but every glimpse we get reflects the most benign character that you could hope to expect to see in a living being. For example, the collective term that's applied to these three Ogo types of Ogo orbs in the Dogon culture is, the word is Titiani. And when you interpret it based on the syllables of the word, what it means is to send, to say hello. Now, these are the same orbs that we saw over New Jersey, the same orbs we persistently see over Scandinavia, but they're the same orbs that over the last decade we've seen 8,000 of them appear near nuclear sites and at point times of nuclear tensions. That there's a 40-foot diameter orb that has been reported to be following one of the nuclear task groups that's out in the ocean right now. It looks as if when we explode a nuclear weapon, it doesn't just do damage in the domain of energy we live in, but it potentially does damage all the way down through these domains. And so the non-material consciousnesses cannot tolerate us using them. And so the story of the day the Earth stood still, where a representative is sent to Earth to announce to us that we're no longer allowed to use these in warfare, that anybody who tries to use it will face unthinkable consequences.
Right. This is why
Biden back in the day of the Ukraine war just casually said to an interviewer one time, "Oh, Putin won't use nuclear weapons in Ukraine," as if it were an established fact.
Yeah.
It's because Biden understood we're not allowed to do that.
Yeah, this is a classic concept in the field of ufology. I hear many UFO contactees convey this same message. It's fascinating to think that there's this sort of overlap. Now, considering the origin of the nuclear weapons program and people like Jack Parsons who were involved in, not directly, I don't know that he was directly involved in the Manhattan Project, but we have all this sort of rumor and speculation about strange rituals going on amongst the people who were creating these weapons. So, you know, it's not surprising to hear that these weapons have effects in the, you know, in our, you know, other realms in the
not right, and those basically resonant domains, you know, the ones we don't see.
Right. And that gives me, you know, thought like, well, what kind of entities? Obviously your statement about hope, I'm with you 100%. I think that is something that humanity's been guided by as far as we can see back in time. There's been, you know, non-corporeal or, you know, non-physical consciousnesses helping us and assisting us. But it also seems that on the opposite end of the spectrum, there are entities who are equally non-physical who don't have our best interests in mind. So, yeah, it is sort of concerning on that note. Do the Dogon people have any information about what we would, you know, consider like a devil type character, as we put it in?
No, where Christianity sees an opposition between good and evil, the Dogon opposition is between truth and error.
Hmm.
And so when an initiate makes a mistake, the only thing that they're obliged to do is to try again.
Yeah.
And to accept the note that, hey, no, this isn't right. It's the instructor's job. Actually, if the initiate asks a question or puts forward a perspective that is appropriate to their level of knowledge, the instructor's job is to affirm it, to convey the truth of the matter to the initiate. But if it's inappropriate to the level of knowledge, or if it's an incorrect perspective, the job of the instructor is to remain silent. Or, if necessary, to lie, if they have to divert the the person from a perspective they shouldn't have. But I told you that each of these levels of consciousness has a proper name that's formulated in a particular way. The primordial consciousness is Re-Na. Her icon is expressed in another ancient Egyptian word, also pronounced Ren. The same two glyphs spell the word, but it's followed by an unpronounced glyph. And that trailing glyph is the picture of a birth mother holding up her newborn baby in the moment that they first regard each other. It's also pronounced Re-Na. It should be pronounced Re-Na. But this is another indication of the character of the non-material, the primordial consciousness, is her icon is having given birth to a newborn, which is as benign an image as we could imagine consciousness adopting.
Yeah.
When I was early in my process writing my books, John Anthony West emailed me. He said, you know, there's a term for the kind of study you're doing. Schwalard Lubitz writes about it in one of his books. And there's an entire chapter about it. The Egyptian Experiment, I think, is the name of the book. He says it's called the Bridge of Sirah. And the idea is, the sort of the mythical presentation is that when truth is ultimately found, it will be found to exist on a razor's edge that sits between two chasms. One represents superstition, the other one represents science. I wrote him back and I thanked him because he had cleared up a long-standing mystery for me. My daughter, when she was 3 years old, before she knew all of her letters of her alphabet or could write, we realized she had artistic talent, and she drew a little sort of better than stick figure picture of me that actually looked like me playing a guitar. And at the top of the picture, she had scribbled five letters that she did know that she insisted said Laird. And we said, fine, that says Laird. We understand that. What she had written was S-I-R-A-H, Sirah, which is the proper formulation or one of the proper formulations of the name of this, of a level of consciousness that exists on the scale of the two universes, non-material and material. S-I is a syllable, like in the word Sirius, that is an icon of the non-material universe. And R-A is the familiar Egyptian word Ra that refers to materialized consciousness. So these are the phonetics that properly go with a level of consciousness that persists between those two universes. And I've had all sorts of indications as I go along that my non-material informant is likely Sirah.
Wow. Yep, children are the, you know, sort of intermediary, it seems, between realms and this realm. You know, you sort of, as you become an adult, you sort of harden those senses that comes to perceive.
Yeah, you learn to put that away. This is why parents have to credit it when they see it, not ridicule it, not discourage it. Right. Both of our children are connected in energetic ways. My wife is connected in certain ways. I myself, at age 18, coming out of high school, would have described myself as the least energetically connected person I knew. I was so not connected to any religion or to any religious outlook that during the Vietnam War era, you could apply for conscientious objector draft status. You could apply on religious grounds, or you could apply on moral grounds. I had no basis to apply on religious grounds, and I knew that no one had ever been granted it on moral grounds. But I applied on moral grounds anyway, and turned out to be the first person in the state of Oregon to be granted conscientious objector status on moral grounds.
Wow.
I had a very close friend from my elementary school days who also applied for that and didn't receive it.
Huh. Well, I commend you for that, especially in these times. You know, not that there's a draft, hopefully, God forbid, there that comes right again, but yeah.
There are rumors of it.
Yeah.
Rumblings of a draft.
Well, Either way, Laird, you're an incredibly brilliant person, and I really, really appreciate you spending the time with us today on the show to help explain your complex work, which is available on your website. You have over 15 books, one on the way.
Actually, they're all available on Amazon. That website isn't really my site. It was a fan site that they tried to sell back to me, so it doesn't really connect to me. I don't even think it's been maintained. Yeah. If you want to find my books, the best place to go probably is Amazon. The traditionally published books are available at simonandschuster.com, where there's a page for me, and intertraditions.com, where there's a page for me. And used copies are probably available on adol.com. Often at a lower price, so that I refer people to that if they want to.
Great. Well, I'll be sure to link the correct address so people can get all of your books. And wonderful stuff. It's really amazing to talk about all of this with you. These are ideas that I've heard about and known about for years, being a fan of this research and an armchair researcher myself. And it's way over my head to have the privilege of talking to you about all this stuff is really incredible. And again, thank you, Laird. So with that, folks, go and follow up with Laird's work to learn more. There is so much more. I would specifically love to have you back on to get further into the Orkney Island situation. I myself up here in the northeast of the United States have come across several megalithic stone structures that aren't necessarily cataloged with anyone outside of maybe the NERA organization. But they're
right.
Fascinating nonetheless. Maybe our mutual friend Ra has probably talked about those with you, but I'd love to have you back on to get into some of those megalithic structures. But again, thank you. And for the audience listening, thank you for tuning in. Follow up with Laird's work. And until next episode, immerse yourself in the moment wherever you are in the now.